From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 119. The chances are good this is coming out to you probably about a day late. I say chances are good because I'm actually recording this on Friday evening. But the way I'm feeling at the moment, it's very unlikely it's going to get to you this evening. So much more likely to be with you on Saturday. It's been a bit of a crappy week, to be honest. I put my back out earlier in the week and I've just generally been feeling a bit pants, as we say in the UK. So sorry about that. Sorry for the delay. I hope you enjoy this second part of my chat with Rafi Sertoli. If you haven't already, go back and catch up by listening to the first part, which is episode number 118. Rafael Sertoli has an MSc in molecular biology and is a PhD candidate in health sciences at the Behavioral and Molecular Lab in Portugal. His understanding of metabolism, nutrition, and clinical medicine all goes into the Nutrita app he built with his team. He loves open scientific debate, CrossFit, football, hiking, and cold water immersion. You can find out more about Rafi's app at nutrita.app and try it for free for 7 days. Should you wish to keep using it, you can get 20% off a monthly or annual subscription by using the code KWP20. As usual, there's a link for it on my links page at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. In this second episode, Rafi talks about some of his pet peeves as well as why cold showers could change your life. You mentioned before that you love experimenting on yourself.
Right.
Tell us a bit more about it. You listed some of the things that you experiment with, and presumably, you know, diet is one of them. But mm-hmm. you mentioned some other things like breath work, breathing practice, cold water exposure.
Yeah. The
That's an interesting one. I have heard a lot about that. It's just the actual doing of it is not necessarily quite so good. But I remember one year, I have a lake fairly near here that I like to swim in the summer. And one year, only happened one year, but one year I just kept on swimming. The first swim of the year, it sort of needs to be a certain temperature. But once I was acclimatized and I carried on swimming, I think the last swim I had was sometime in November, and it was 8 degrees Celsius, that is. So pretty cold. But actually, it was something I could tolerate because I'd got used to it over a period of time. People thought I was mad. There were people who were walking their dogs and stuff, and they saw this crazy English woman swimming in this freezing cold lake. Were all quite concerned about what I was doing. But I can remember the feeling. I can remember the invigoration you get from it. So I can see why there would be benefits. And interestingly, that we were talking about mental health, I've heard that it can be very good for that.
Yeah, it's funny. Vincent van Gogh was, I think it was him who was treated with ice baths to cure his I can't remember what diagnosis he had, but his insanity, essentially.
Oh, interesting.
And this was, of course, sort of one of those funny anecdotes, but I won't really start talking about it in terms of a treatment for mental health. I think it does have those interesting properties, but what I will say about it, sort of as a most interesting feature for me, is that it's probably one of the most underused and sort of forgotten levers you can pull to really boost your immune system. Having your body trained to regulate its temperature better has to be done by pushing it into the extremes of the hot and the cold. We know that there are a lot of physiological adaptations that happens on the extremes. When you're in the cold, your vascular system has to be able to respond appropriately. And that means at pretty much every level of your vascular system, whether that's the tiny, tiny capillaries in your hands or the arteries, you know, pumping blood throughout your body, everything has to expand or contract to the point where you have good blood flow. Because, of course, good blood flow means good temperature control to a large extent, because blood is warm. You need the whole endocrine system to wake up and start producing enough adrenaline to really start getting heat produced, you know, in your cells. Heat, your cells can, if you imagine the clutch of a car and you just press on the clutch and accelerate, you're going to produce a lot of heat and noise, but you're not going to move forward. Mm. And your body heats itself doing that. Your mitochondria sort of uncouple, which would be the pressing of the clutch, and a lot of heat is produced and a lot of your energy needs go into heat production. And that's, of course, a large shift in your metabolism as well. I mean, you're really diverting your energy towards heating yourself versus something else. And this whole beautiful symphony and shift that goes throughout your body is an important way for your body to maintain its core temperature. And that's crucial because our enzymes work at very specific temperatures in our body. They have a limited range, you know, and really being able to keep your body in that range when you go from a cold room to a hot room, or cold conditions to warm conditions, humid conditions, dry conditions, that affects, of course, the bacteria and the bacteria in your body, not just outside your body, and the viruses in your body. And you can tip the scales favorably or unfavorably, depending on how well you respond. And I think using the cold to train your immune system, you could say the same about the heat to some extent, you know, using temperature basically to boost your immune system, I think is really underappreciated. I think it's one of those things where it should kind of be like brushing your teeth. I know, which is a horrible idea for most people, but in terms of health benefits, like what it means to regularly take cold showers, I think really is the equivalent from being sick, you know, a handful of times a year to maybe down to one, two, or none. That's actually pretty significant when you think about, you know, how that affects large numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's safe, it's cheap, it's simple, it's supported, I would say, by a lot of evidence. I mean, I could go into all the clinical evidence and the experiments done with the Iceman that people might have seen in the Vice documentary, where this man shows how you can stay in the cold by controlling his breath, which would get us into breath work and all of that.
Yeah, it's the person I've been thinking of, actually. I haven't really looked that much into it, but a friend of mine mentioned it. Wim Hof, isn't it? And he's built a whole thing around it and training people to work with it. It does sound fascinating.
It's great.
What does it mean in the practical sense?
Yeah.
Literally taking cold showers by the sounds of it.
Yeah. So essentially what I suggest people do is they combine breath work with cold exposure. At the very basic level, what you learn to do is to withstand a cold shower. And everyone will notice that when they get into the cold, or especially under cold water, they sort of tense up and they can't breathe deeply and normally. They have shallow breathing and, you know, it's sort of this reflex. It's very hard to...
Yes, I remember reading about that actually when I was swimming in this cold water.
Right.
And they were talking about the potential. And I got into reading about these people, you know, who swim every day of the year and swim through the winter open water swimming.
Yeah.
And yes, that's where I read about that. I can see why you need to link the two, the breathing, because they were talking about it from a safety aspect.
Yeah, you just notice it right away. I mean, I think it's the same for everyone, really. And so basically what the breath work teaches you to do is to maintain your body temperature, and repeatedly being exposed to the cold sort of lessens your nervous system response, where it's this involuntary response where it tenses up.
Mm-hmm.
And the breath work, what it does is it's a fascinating new discovery, really, that it plays instead of the central nervous system that you control sort of more consciously. You have an autonomous nervous system, which you don't really control to the same extent, like the breathing and many other processes in your body and your heartbeat and all of that. And basically, when you get into the shower, this reflex that you can't control sort of tenses up. And by working through the breathing cycles, which I'll explain shortly, you essentially give some higher degree of control to your autonomous nervous system, the one which you're not supposed to be able to control according to the dogma in biology.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially you rid yourself of that tensing reflex. You start to breathe better, breathe deeper, to hyper oxygen, sort of to start really bringing more CO2 initially and then oxygen into your blood, because you adapt to that as well. And you can maintain your body temperature because the pH, you know, this shift in pH, this very little small shift in pH in your blood that signals your buffering system to keep that nice and level. All of that seems to have an effect on the heat production of the body.
Hmm.
This mix of, you do this breath work basically, which is breathing in 100% deeply, breathing out partially, and doing that maybe 30, 50 times. It's called a hypocapnic hypoventilation, a hyperventilation. Basically, what happens in your blood is your CO2 goes up and then it goes back down. And you have these sort of pressures that your body has to adapt to. It has to buffer that acidity from the CO2 because you're not breathing out the air, which you should be breathing out more CO2.
Right.
And by having this hypocapnic state, you really start to have to get more bicarbonate released, more of that buffering agent released. And it helps you maintain your body heat. This response also induces sort of an immune response that can neutralize the LPS from bacteria.
Hmm.
So this was tested in subjects, in clinical subjects, guided by Wim Hof. So he said, this is not just me. Anyone can do this. He proved it in the clinic, which is remarkable. So people are injected with LPS, which is pretty much like sort of being in, someone causes sepsis or causes a fever state, and you just react. I mean, you don't have control how your immune system reacts normally. And with this exercise, this breath work, which maintains your body heat, which releases adrenaline more than, you know, in someone who's bungee jumping, you're just sitting there in your bed doing your breath work. It's remarkable. And it can bind neutralize the fever response and the symptoms of responding to what should be in your blood, usually the LPS, right? You've injected this thing that should not be there.
It's amazing.
And your immune response is modulated. And to me, it's such a beautiful example of going back to some very basic principles of how our body has evolved to deal with, you know, heat and cold and bacterial insults. And a lot of the things that we thought were uncontrollable, like our autonomous nervous system, are actually proving to be, you know, a higher degree of control than initially thought, which is really exciting. And with a very simple, cheap, I mean, it's free to breathe that way. Anyone can do it. You know, and being exposed to the cold, all of this together is a really powerful, you know, intervention. And I can say more about the therapeutic aspects afterwards, if you want, from the mental health perspective.
Yes, keep going. I mean, I do think it's really fascinating. I can remember reading about a combination. They talk about a good temperature for sleeping in. And there was a study that compared two groups of men sleeping, and the difference in temperature wasn't that much. I don't know, 5 degrees difference or something, perhaps even less than that. But they had a much better fat composition, because doesn't it change? It changes the kind of fat you have to a better kind of fat if you subject yourself to colder temperatures more often.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty incredible, because it can affect insulin sensitivity in patients with type 2 diabetes. I mean, that's how powerful the cold is. They can measure meaningful differences in type 2 diabetics. Yeah, and they can also change the nature of your fat. What it does is it's going to increase brown adipose tissue, mm-hmm. right? It's going to increase the mass of brown adipose tissue you have, which people might be asking, well, what's brown adipose tissue? It's a different kind of fat that you would typically have on your belly or on your bum, right? The brown adipose tissue is more dense with mitochondria, and it can produce more heat than the white fat. And that's probably another reason why fat tissue should be considered part of the immune system, in my opinion. But it's a conversation for another time. Fat is very interesting. It's not this inert thing. Anyways, what it does is the exposure to the cold not only changes the brown adipose tissue, but it also allows, you know, one study noted a 43% improvement in peripheral insulin sensitivity in type 2 diabetics. So, to give people an idea of what that actually means, is that the type 2 diabetic, whose fundamental issue, you know, in their disease is that the insulin signaling to handle the blood sugar and the energy in the body is just not responding appropriately, or is overtaxed in a sense. The signal to noise ratio is poor, and improving that insulin sensitivity just by changing temperature, essentially an exposure to temperature, you know, can reduce it by nearly half. That's pretty interesting, right? You can change the disease state just playing with the cold. And it sort of gets us back to again, the question of mismatch and all of that. So, yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, it blows my mind the impact these things, like you say, that are free to do.
Yeah.
Fairly easy to do, I suppose. Potentially uncomfortable to do. Might not be. It's almost something that should be prescribed. Okay, here I've got something that's going to change your insulin sensitivity.
Right.
Prescribe so many cold showers and breathing methods every week.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that explains why in some ways more people aren't doing it, but yeah. It's also just that they don't know about it.
Yeah. And it's one of those things. It's always great to have a very clear idea of how you could be wrong. And it would be very easy. You could measure your glucose. And if your doctor is willing to prescribe you a fasting insulin test, you could, you know, retest your fasting insulin and see if this is a bunch of nonsense or not. And that would be, I think, a great thing to suggest people try. Yeah, it's uncomfortable. You know, in this study, it was, 10 days of cold acclimation to 14, 15 degrees Celsius. So how much is that in Fahrenheit? I'm terrible at that.
Yes, I don't know.
Yeah, it's chilly. You would want to put a little something more than a t-shirt if you walked out of your house and it was 14, 15 degrees. So just that, you know, made a difference. So cold showers, breath work, there's a big lever to pull there, I think, that people just might not be aware of for the most part.
Absolutely. I can remember watching a program and it was all to do with type 2 diabetes, and they had them in this house for, I forget for how long, but it was certainly a number of weeks. They were feeding them some kind of shake or something. It was all about reducing, you know, their average blood glucose. But one of the experiments they did that was fascinating, that showed results just in 24 hours, they had them every hour, I think it was for 5 minutes, an alarm went off in the house. And when the alarm went off, they all had to get up and do some form of exercise for 5 minutes. It could be jumping on the spot. It could just be walking around the house and the grounds, whatever they were able to do. But they had to get up and move. And they did this, I think it was just for 24 hours. And I don't think, you know, they didn't make them literally do it for 24 hours. It was during the hours that they were awake. And I forget what the drop was, but it was significant overall that their blood sugar had dropped.
Absolutely. And it's not surprising given that, you know, we know that going for a walk after your meal makes a difference. Mm. I mean, how many people would you guess know that? Off the top of your head, like an honest guess, I would say less than 2% of people.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised, and you know, and I'm someone who's interested in all these things, and I was surprised at the difference in such a short period of time.
Yeah, and these things are like measurable. They have some very logical, you know, backing from physiology. There's even clinical data on these things, and yet they're not part of the normal discussion in a doctor's office who sees a ton of diabetics and obese people and people with dysregulated blood sugars with all sorts of problems. It makes me think of one of my neighbors. This lady is suffering from arthritis and she actually feels that the cold hurts her hands, which is probably actually definitely true in her arthritic state. Yet no one's telling her, yeah, it's true. It might hurt, but you know, you go at it sort of methodically and gently, and this thing that's hurting you, the cold, is now going to help you to paradoxically warm up, bring blood flow to those areas that are poorly fed by your vascular system at present, you know? And you could have a change in quality of life. You could restart your pottery that you can't do anymore. Mm. And to some degree, you don't need to, you know, look at the side effects of a medication and weigh that up, which, let's be honest, it takes a doctor in theory. Yet we all have to do it as patients. Yet we could be taught about something relatively straightforward. You could teach a child to do it. And there's just not part of, you know, these things are so common, the aches and pains, the arthritis, the high blood sugars. And we have these very cheap, cheap methods. So I love telling people about it because it's sort of, they give you funny looks when you tell them you do cold showers, or they see you swimming in, you know, in the middle of the river or whatever in December when everyone's with their Christmas hat on or something. But
yeah, that's an interesting point about goals as well, I think, isn't it? And having the right idea about setting goals and creating the right image around that. And that's a difference where you spoke about this woman with her arthritic fingers. And some people would talk about these sort of general goals. Oh, I just, you know, I want it to be less painful or whatever it is. Just it's slightly sort of just two general goals. Whereas you hit the nail on the head there with saying, if your goal and you have this real detailed image around it, picturing yourself doing your pottery again. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goal is the kind of goal that, if people can really picture it very clearly in their minds, will help them stick to these different steps that they can take to get them there.
Yeah, my mother promised me this year to start being coached by a friend of mine who's a strength coach, and she's nearly 70 years old. So that's her New Year's resolution, and after years of bullying her into trying to get stronger, she's starting to notice everyday things that would really be helped if she were just a little bit stronger, you know? Yeah, it's funny because you don't have that same advantage of clear. I mean, people when they're overweight in 20, yeah, I mean, they get bad looks and they feel bad, but I don't think it's the same as the pain necessarily of arthritis or something. Some things just make us change quicker. And I don't know, obesity seems to be so common now. I'm not even sure if the stigma is really the same or not. It's just an interesting difference in what makes us take the step to make a big change, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm always very curious about that and ask people about it because I've really not had to do that myself, but yet I'm very interested in asking people about it.
So you experiment with all these different things and presumably some things stick and some things don't depending on the results you have. But it sounds like you've had good results with the cold water and the breathing. That's something that you incorporate into your daily life.
Yeah, I haven't done the breath work in many months on a daily basis. I've just done it here and there. The cold showers I do all the time. And by the way, that doesn't mean you never have a hot shower.
It sounds like a good way to save on your heating bills.
Exactly. It's just that it's common, it's normal to have a cold shower as well. You know, people often, I don't know, have a shower in the morning and then shower before going to bed. Maybe that's pretty typical. You can have one hot, one cold, right? I mean, that's fine. The hot is not undoing what you've done with the cold. And interestingly enough, so yeah, you can do that. For me, it's the cold showers. It's the breath work. It's the meditation, which I've started again, which I had done a couple of years ago and found it pretty useful. It's everything from minimalist shoes, you know? It's from making sure that when people are with a little jacket on, I'm out in a shirt usually and get funny looks, but never mind. I just enjoy the same wear in all seasons if it's not raining too bad. So it's that, and it's the nutrition. So for me currently, I'm on I would say 95% carnivore diet, where every couple of a week or two when I go out for dinner, I might have a dessert or something. But otherwise, I usually just have meat, fish, dairy, eggs, that sort of stuff.
And how has that evolved over time? You're saying you've been keto for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that has evolved over that time. Yeah. How has it changed?
I started out eating so pretty much like everyone that would have grown up in the south of France, where you have some great culinary traditions, some really good habits, and a lot of the same terrible ones that everyone have, I would say a standard diet. And then I just went to straight away cutting out bread and sugar. So it was immediately low carb. And my carbs were in the form then of, you know, dairy, starches, fruit. So it's probably just typical 15-20% low carb diet, I would say. But straight away, I just didn't really want to have anything to do with grains and legumes for the most part. I pretty much just stuck to vegetables and nuts and seeds and that sort of stuff. It was, you know, pretty much what everyone would look at and say, oh, that's a nice colorful plate of, I would say, 3/4 vegetables and a generous portion of fat, you know, whether that's olive oil, coconut oil, butter, and then some meat and whatever, some fish or something, some eggs. So that's how it started out. And then with time, really mostly guided by a mix of experimenting and my digestion, which had just never been great with that amount of plants, to be honest. It just started becoming obvious to me. Progressively, I just found going just or lower carb and or going lower in vegetables and fruit and especially nuts and all of that. My digestion just got better. Mm. So eventually it turned into a carnivore diet. And I just thought, oh, well, I'll just give it a try for a month before the carnivore conference that I went to. And I just happened to say to myself, well, it seems to be working better than expected. Not everything's perfect. It's just it's better. And, you know, I'll take better. You know, I eat some liver and kidneys and brains and all that. I love all that nasty stuff.
Do the whole nose to tail.
Yeah. I just really like it. I mean, I think there's a great argument for including a little of it here and there for everyone, regardless of your diet, to be honest. I just like it. And it's cheap. And it's probably a pretty sustainable thing to do, to consume parts of animals that are usually discarded or wasted, and they're very nutritious. So I think it's a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, I have to say, wasted less so in France. It's something that I've noticed. One, it's more readily available and quite a variety, but that it's not necessarily that cheap. It's the kind of thing in the UK that would be cheap because nobody wants it.
Yeah.
In France, people eat it a lot more.
Yeah.
I have to say, overall, you mentioned about the typical kind of diet that you'd find in the south of France. I would say overall, it is changing, and I've seen it change since I've been here, which is about 16 years. But I would say overall, the French diet is certainly healthier than the average UK diet. There's a lot fewer processed foods.
Totally agree.
When you're in the supermarket, they are creeping in and the areas are growing for those kind of ready meals and processed type foods. Mm-hmm. But you don't have the aisles and aisles and aisles of it that you do in the UK. I've always noticed that, the difference in what's available in the shops, and that cooking is much more of an integral, normal part of everyone's daily practice, whereas it's not necessarily in the UK, and America's the same.
I mean, it's not uncommon in France. You go to someone's place, they put out, you know, cheese and charcuterie on the table. Mm. And I'm talking students. I'm not talking, you know, rich people. I'm just talking average students, some decent quality cured meats, maybe a cheap wine, which in France is pretty good.
Yeah.
Maybe some nuts, you know, and then you can have quite a lot of all of that, and then have, you know, something like, I don't know, a piece of steak and some vegetables or something. And that's it. That's a normal French meal. Now, they also have pizza and candy and all the nonsense, but you're not surprised if someone feeds you that in France. Yeah. So that would be so easy for me to go to someone's house and, you know, not have to say anything. And in fact, it's always very easy for me to go to a restaurant or something that, 9 times out of 10, and actually even more than that, I would say, maybe 99 times out of 100, I always find something.
Yes, I find it fairly easy to eat out in France.
Yeah. I mean, there's always some good options. I think you could say that to about the UK, but I think there just are some places where you just couldn't. But you could say that for someone living in London, I think. There should always be an option for you. I guess it depends on the towns and how rural the area is. But yeah, it's not the same in the UK.
I can remember walking around Chichester, so a fairly big place, trying to find somewhere for lunch. And it was actually really difficult to find something that wasn't basically sandwiches. Really, really hard, actually.
Yeah, when I was studying in Staffordshire, at Staffordshire University over the summer, it was pretty much a food desert if you didn't go to the supermarket, basically. No, so it can be really bad. But hopefully, you know, that's the sort of practical advice that people can get through articles and apps and podcasts and that sort of stuff. I've got hope for that. People are resourceful when they want to.
Yes, absolutely. And like you say, there are always supermarkets. One of the other things that was on your list of pet peeves, and I wonder how much it's something you've experimented with, this very, how shall we put it, fevered debate around fat versus protein.
Oh, yeah.
It seems to people get very, very heated about it in the keto community.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? You know, where do you stand? Have you compared the two on yourself? And what are your thoughts on it?
I've done some sort of very, very light. If I was just being observant about how I felt and performed, varying my fat intake, I can't say I didn't experiment like Shaban or Dave Feldman might do. For me, what seems obvious is that the protein leverage hypothesis, which is the idea that basically, eat as much high quality protein as you can, and keep fat and carbs as low as you can. And if you can do that, it's pretty much the fastest way to lose body fat without outright fasting. And it's the best way to lose body fat. Generally, these people would argue, because you would maintain your lean body mass, which would get us back to great body composition.
Mm-hmm.
So I really liked what Amber was saying on that point of, it sounds really intuitive, just decrease all the energy and keep the building blocks, which is the muscle and the protein and all that stuff. And, you know, the fatter you are, the easier it's going to be for you basically to keep that up, because, well, you have a lot of fat. So what's the problem? She's right. She did a really good description of it. And the problem is that you might be limited by how much fat you can get out of your fat tissue. And there are a few different things affecting that, and maybe how much fat you re-esterify, meaning that you store back up fat that goes back out, travels through your blood. Is it going to be used for energy, or is it going to be stored back again? You know, our fat tissue cycles fat in and out of it. So who's to say that your fat is going to respond as you'd want it to and allow you just to live off that protein comfortably? Yeah, it's a great, let's explore that. Let's see what's the evidence for it. And if you actually look at it, well, we just know that the extreme version of that is rabbit starvation. Okay, that's obvious. That's an easy one. That just means you're, it's also in cases where people also get too few calories or they can't eat enough calories mm-hmm. and are thus in a starvation state. So that's the extreme end of the spectrum. On the other hand, you have people saying, look, I was on a ketogenic diet. My carbs were zero, basically, or close to that. And now I've just cut out some of the fat. Seems to be getting better. I don't dispute that for a moment. I think it's definitely the case for quite a few people, but I can't explain it, to be perfectly honest. I don't know why it works in those cases. And for people like Amber and many others, that's not how their satiety works. I know for myself, and I have no body composition. I have no excess fat, I should say, really. And I know that if I go too low in fat, I don't have enough energy. So it would somehow support, you know, the basic intuitive idea. Yeah. On the other hand, I know that if I go too high fat, like, I don't know, maybe above 85% or something, or sometimes maybe it's just 80, who knows exactly. I don't have a scale with me. Yeah, I can't eat enough and then I'm hungry. So, I think really both seem to be true to some extent. You can not eat enough if you force the protein. And if you go sufficiently high enough, well, can't really eat enough either. So in my case, I have to find, because I'm trying to put on more muscle mass, I really have to feed myself according to my taste. I have to play with maybe some heavy cream or some added butter or very fatty cuts, or keep the kidney fat that's around the kidney if I'm having that, for example. So I just really can go by taste. But I think for a lot of people who are just used to junk food, it's going to take a while for their taste to normalize. So they don't even have that ability to use taste as a guide. Who knows what's going on there for some people. So it could be that. It could be the rate of fat release from the fat cells, as Amber says, that makes it hard to believe that it's just that easy, basically, and would fit with her example as being an example of someone for who it hasn't worked. I think it's one of those cases where we're at the point of saying we have very good examples on both sides that increasing your protein or really increasing your fat can help. So experiment with that and don't make protein into this can do no harm macronutrient, because that just doesn't make any sense. And yes, you can, in theory, do the same with carbs, according to the energy model, meaning you could keep your fat super low and your carbs super high, and you'd get the same result, but that's not true either. Mm. It's not that simple. I mean, to some degree, people, as bodybuilders have shown us, you can keep your carbs high and in your high protein diet and be in a fat loss state. Yeah, that's possible. Doesn't mean it's the healthiest way of doing it or that it's equivalent to doing that with fat. It's not. It's comparable, but it's not equivalent. So yeah, I think it'd just be good to have that maybe a bit more appreciated, I guess, that we're really at the stage of just saying, let's try to figure out why it works for some people and not others. There probably is one way that's slightly better than the other, I would guess. I just don't know which, to be perfectly honest.
And also, I just think it comes down to varying on the individual and all the things that are on the different sides of the scale. I really liked Amber's way of deciding how well something is working for you, and that with the hunger signals. I thought that was fascinating.
Yep.
To say that if you're feeling really hungry, then that's actually quite a good indicator that mm-hmm. that particular diet that you've set out for yourself is not working how it should be, which so goes against this whole feeling that we have to really suffer through a diet. I loved that. I thought that was a really good way of looking at it.
I agree. And personally, I would for myself, I would extend it to, I use how hungry I am and my sense of fullness to see really if how my stress is affecting me. If I get too stressed, I undereat. Or I don't know if I'm undereating or if it's just I'm in a state where I don't hold on to muscle as well. So it could be a bit of both, but definitely my hunger is affected. Like if I get, I don't know, terrible news or something, you know, my hunger goes. So it's I think it's interesting to listen to those cues our body gives us. And that's why I think it's so smart to suggest, as Amber did, that if your diet is leaving continuously hungry and you're not, you know, obviously restricting excessively, and you know why, but that should not be the case. One of the things that should get better as well is your hunger signals. And to the extent that you can improve it, you really should. It should be one of the signals you triangulate with, essentially.
And that's interesting where you mentioned stress. See, a lot of people's stress response when it comes to hunger is that they get hungry and want to eat more. Yeah. So isn't it interesting as, you know, you go one way and somebody else will go the other way?
Yeah, it's one of those things where we're not able to derive some good principles to explain that yet. We're just not there. Not for stress and appetite, certainly. I think we are getting close to it with the macronutrients, like with Dr. Ludwig's study showing for every, 10% decrease in dietary carbs in your diet, you get, I can't remember it now, but you get a significant decrease in, essentially you're in a higher caloric deficit, everything else being equal, to a sufficient extent where over many, many days and weeks and months, it really could help the fat loss that a person would be seeking on the diet where carbohydrates are decreased. So I think we've got some really interesting principles, but it's not clear how to apply it in specific cases. I think that's where we have to maybe keep both of those things in our minds. We have some principles, but that doesn't mean we know how to apply them to everyone.
Absolutely. And how much do you think there's a difference between men and women's physiology when it comes to diet? One of the things that was on your pet peeves list was this default assumption that women's physiology is delicate, quote unquote.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be just my sampling bias or something, but both my mother and my girlfriend can easily, you know, my girlfriend eats once a day, pretty much for the most part. And my mother can easily intermittently fast, just, you know, not forcing it or anything at all. You know, easily 16 hours, 18 hours, better than my dad can, for instance. So I don't know if it's where this idea come from exactly, that women are this, you know, they should be so, so cautious about fasting and so, so cautious about ketogenic diets. I get that, you know, we have to give caveats for women because their reproductive pressures they're under in terms of their physiology is very different from men. And, you know, you can look at the fertility as an indicator of health, of course. And yeah, definitely. And all those caveats being said, I don't know, you know, women have more fat stores than men.
Well, I was just thinking that. When you were saying about how you've seen with this limited sample that these two women that you know find it easier to fast than your father does.
No.
And the first thing that came to my mind was the average body fat of a woman is higher than a man. And that definitely plays a part in the ability to fast.
Yeah.
Richard Morris talks about that a lot, that he likes a certain amount of body fat because it gives him the ability to be able to fast for 3 days if he wants to, where someone who is extremely lean would find that very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, this is interesting what Richard mentioned there. We talked about that quite a bit with him. I don't know. I don't think I'd be able to fast as well as I did a few years back. I think I'm around 10% body fat, give or take 0.5% either way. And when I first started fasting, of which 5 days was the longest, I think I must probably been around 12%. And I think that already makes a difference, actually, those few percent at those low levels. I don't know. I'll have to try again and tell you, but I don't really have the same need for it as I did before, in the sense that before I was experimenting and just, you know, seeing what I could do fasted, basically. But now I'm rather in a phase of putting on mass, so I don't need these extended fasts really anymore. But as far as what, you know, to come back to what the differences between men and women in terms of nutrition and physiology, it's this overly cautious. I think it's not even that. It's nearly reprimands that we give women, like, be careful. Like, you know, like, it's not the same for you. And I just don't think we know that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I love it when I see women who CrossFit and they're pregnant. I think it's great. It's a fantastic example. And yet people are so freaked out by it. I love it when women, or I know another woman, a very good friend of mine, she was running until her, I don't know, seventh month or whatever. And she's like really good runner. Mm. I think we have these expectations of delicacy, but yeah, if you,
not gonna break.
You know, once again, you know, I'm bringing us back to evolutionary biology here. Imagine what it means to survive in the wild while pregnant. There's no, like, delicacy doesn't come into it.
No.
At no point. So I'm always surprised at the default assumption we have, really, about, you know, what's sort of harmful there in terms of the sex differences. I think for women, really, the biggest issue we see on ketogenic diets is restricting calories beyond really what they should be doing. Mm. And also this fear of fat. I think it's, you know, as Amy Berger points out, it's this, a salad and a sliver of chicken breast, picture,
yeah,
with a very dainty lady, with her fork in the hand, you know, having a bite of that. And I think that's, yeah, that's a bunch of crap. I hate that message. And, I think it's really important for women to feel, just to not make any particular assumptions beyond what sort of bleedingly obvious, like, yeah, you have a reproductive cycle that's more consequent. So you're not going to do fasting while you're pregnant, for example. I mean, you know, those sort of caveats there. So I think a bit more common sense and, you know, fewer assumptions would do us some good in that debate. And, yeah, that's it pretty much. That's my pet peeve.
I had an interesting discussion with somebody with I get very confused about my timeline of when the podcast is going to come out compared to when I recorded it. But Rayanne Sparks was talking about lipedema, and she was talking about the evolutionary aspect and thinking about why certain diseases came into being. And she was looking at it at a very interesting lens of saying that this was actually the, you know, the women, and it just seemed to go back a long way, lipedema. These women who had this, who had these fat stores, were the ones who would potentially, you know, survive the famine and things like that. They were the ones who could fast for longer. They were the ones who had this strength, the strength in the tribe to still be standing. I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, we shouldn't take for granted what evolution has given us. And if women have higher fat stores, not just when they're pregnant, of course, but, you know, throughout the year, there's a reason for that.
Mm.
And, you know, I guess it circles us back to the protein sparing modifies fast discussion, that it's probably, it's a fat loss tool, but there you might expect women to have more obvious signs quickly because the reproductive cycle is often so sensitive to that. For men, it might manifest, you know, I don't know, maybe a bit more slowly or something. So in that sense, I guess there's a sensitivity to women that's pretty useful, but I wouldn't, you know, call that, you know, delicacy.
No.
Being delicate.
Delicate flowers.
Yeah.
Most of us aren't like, yeah, that. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you and going about all over the place. Very interesting conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you, Daisy. Same for me. Likewise.
I wonder if you could leave us with a top tip.
Yeah. So I was going to say cold showers, but I've already talked about that. Yeah, I would guess, what's my top tip? I'll cheat and I'll tell you my nutritional top tip. And then I'll tell you about another one. My nutritional top tip would be to forget about diet camps and try to apply this very simple rule, which is hard to do in real life, but it's avoid flour, added sugars, and high omega-6 seed oils. So those are the trifecta I think I've identified as being most diet agnostic in a sense, and that people should avoid. So that's flour, like wheat flour, soybean flour, or wheat oil, or soybean oil, or rice oil, all that sort of stuff. So avoid flour products more generally, with a few exceptions here and there, but for that we can go into more detail. And yeah, and just sugar, added sugar, all of that stuff. So that'll be my nutritional top tip. My non-nutritional top tip, since I've already talked about cold showers and breath work, would really be to take me as an example, not to imitate. And in that sense, would mean to really start appreciating as early as you can the importance of community and having a good friendship. I think we tend to separate that from discussions of health, but I think you could make a very strong argument for the, I don't know if it's the feeling of human connectedness or the physical proximity, but let's just call it connection, whether that's with family, friends, lovers, whatever. Getting connected, feeling connected to people, feeling like you have a depth to your relationships and your experiences with them. I think that has a tremendous impact on our health. I really do think there is strong evidence for that. And it'd be a great discussion to have in the future. But people can check out an episode of Nourish, Balance, Thrive, where they were talking about the, you know, how you construct your environment and that, how that has extremely strong evidence in terms of health outcomes and mortality. Yeah, people should try to appreciate it quicker and better than I did. It took me a while to understand the importance of that. So that's actually something that's been a very big difference in my life, where I've had to make a conscious effort of tending to that as I would other aspects of you know, daily habits and stuff. So hopefully that'll prove useful to people, if not too general.
Absolutely. And we'll put everything in the show notes, but where can people find you?
Yeah, so they can find me on Twitter. I'm at RaphaelS7, Raphael with a PH. And they can basically visit the Nutrita website if they really want to know our approach to diet and health, and if they want some support, if they want an app to help them get some really good information about their diet. Well, it's Nutrita.app. And yeah, you can sign up for free. No need to put in your credit card or anything. Just have a look around, see if it's helpful. And yeah, you can always book an expert consult with me. So I'm happy to talk to people who use the app and see how they're, you know, benefiting from it, and if I can help them get more value out of it. So we're big on having everyone who uses it be able to set an appointment. And yeah, hopefully have an interesting exchange.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. It's been a very great pleasure talking to you today, Rafi. Thank you.
Me too. Thank you, Daisy.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Lewis Carroll and could have been written for me. She generally gave herself very good advice, though she very seldom followed it. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.